bit embarrassing, really, but I need to tell you that I have broken a law this week. In the UK, it is illegal to beat or shake a carpet or rug in the street, though you are allowed to shake a doormat, but only before 8 a.m. I haven't been arrested for this crime, thankfully, but in Samoa, they have a law where it's illegal to forget your wife's birthday. Steve's laughing. It's tomorrow? Okay. I'm so far so good on that one, I think. In France, it's illegal to name a pig Napoleon. Fair enough. In Milan, Italy, and I don't know if Brooke and Daniel are going there, but it is a legal requirement that you must smile at all times. Apparently, exceptions are made for funerals and hospital visits, which I think is very fair. Now, we hear these laws, and they sound silly, and they sound completely irrelevant to us, but they have a context, they have a reason that they're there, and they've just been kind of forgotten about. But we can often have that same attitude towards passages like Exodus 21 to 23, and we come to these laws, we read them, and on one hand, we know all scriptures God breathed, it's important, we need to take it in, and on the other hand, what on earth does this have to do with me? How does this apply to me today? The main idea here is that Israel, they're called a holy nation, and now they're called to act like a holy nation. They represent God. When another nation or people, they look at Israel, they should see a clear reflection of who God is: merciful, compassionate, just, and holy. Just like when Stowmarket looks at us here at Stowmarket Baptist Church, what do they see? They should see God's character, who God is reflected in the way we live our daily lives. You know, the decisions we make, what we do and what we do not do. Now, how many of us have a Bible verse framed on a wall or printed on a mug at home? Anyone? Cool. Now, I bet it's something nice like, you know, be still and know that I am God. I'm guessing no one has Exodus 21:28, which is when an ox gores a man or woman to death. That would be weird. But in these three chapters of Exodus, God is taking these 10 commandments that we heard about last week from the stone tablets and then rubbing them into the awkward mess of ordinary everyday life. He's teaching a newly redeemed people what it actually looks like to stop living like Egyptians. Israel has come out of Egypt, but now Egypt must come out of Israel. So these are highly relevant to us. What we're going to look at is 3 points this morning. Point one would be getting Egypt out of our power dynamics, and that's chapter 21, kind of looking most of the chapter, so 1 to 27. And then point number two, getting Egypt out of our relationships. That will be 21, 28, up to 22, 27. And then finally, point three will be getting Egypt out of our worship. That will be 22, 31, going to 23, 19. Point number one, getting Egypt out of our power dynamics. Now, Hannah and I often do a games night together on a Friday, and one of our favorite games to play is Monopoly, though I don't know why, because I'm yet to win a game. I'll have you know, she also beat me at bowling yesterday and beat me 7-0 at the air hockey, so I've got a lot to make up for. But we all know how Monopoly works, don't we? The entire goal of the game is to acquire as much power and property as possible, to crush your opponents, and to show absolutely zero mercy when your husband lands on Mayfair and you've got a hotel on there, right? Now, that is exactly how Pharaoh ran Egypt. He played Monopoly with human lives. The strong dominate the weak. And the danger for the Israelites and the danger for us is that when they have been oppressed for that long, the temptation is to then want to become like Pharaoh and do the oppressing themselves. That has just seeped into their minds and their way of working and their way of living. But God says, not in my kingdom, not in my people. In Exodus 21, God is saying, I've rescued you, I have brought you out, I've made you mine, and now this is what life looks like when you belong to me. You know, Israel, they've spent generations under Pharaoh, and Pharaoh's way of ruling was built on oppression. Pharaoh looked at human beings, and he didn't see people. He saw property. He did not look at the Israelites and see these image bearers made by God with dignity and worth. He looked at them and saw how useful they would be to his kingdom. And that's not so different to the world we live in today, is it? And now here in this passage, God is saying, you can't be like that. You know what it is to be crushed. You know what it is to be voiceless. You know what it is to have no power, no advocate, no protection. So now that I've rescued you, don't you dare build another Egypt amongst yourselves. Be distinct. Be holy. I have declared you to be a holy nation. Now live it. And that is the heart of the first half of Exodus 21. You know, if Egypt is going to come out of Israel, it has to start with how they handle their power. Now the first major section, verses 2 to 11, it deals with servants or slaves in the ESV. And we hear that word and we often think of the horrors of the slave trade. But God is not endorsing Pharaoh's brutal system of slavery that he had, where human beings are reduced to property. Instead, the context here is in ancient Israel, this was often a way out of extreme poverty. If you didn't have enough money, if you had debts that you couldn't clear, you would give yourself to someone as a servant. It's the same idea of like, we had this idea, this notion that if you go to a restaurant and you can't afford to pay for your meal, you go back in the back and you do the washing up until your debt is cleared. It's that kind of idea. But notice what God does. He meets this harsh, fallen culture exactly where it is, and he injects this unprecedented human right. Look at verse 2. A Hebrew servant works for 6 years, but in the seventh, he goes free. God is telling this powerful master, your wealth doesn't give you unlimited rights. Power has limits because people have dignity. And this protection runs throughout this whole section. You know, if a master permanently injures a servant, even knocking out a tooth, the servant goes free. You can't just treat them how you like. If a female servant is taken into a household, she cannot be exploited or thrown away. In fact, God writes her dignity into his law. God is putting a fence around power. He's saying to the strong, you may not use your authority as if you are Pharaoh. And friends, this lands with us today. We have power over people. You know, a parent has power over their child. An employer with an employee. A husband with a wife. A church leader. Or even just the strong personality in a difficult conversation. The question becomes, do I use the power I have under God for the good of others or not? Then from verse 12 onwards, the focus turns to violence. Whoever strikes a man so that he dies shall be put to death. And this tells us something very clear. Again, human life matters to God. Why? Because human beings are made in the image of God. To attack a human life is not merely to just attack a creature. It is to attack one who bears the image of the Creator. It isn't something to be taken lightly. It is significant. And that is why, as a church, we are against abortion. Taking life is not something to be taken so lightly. Then take a look at verse 14, which says that if someone acts deliberately and plans to kill another person, even if he runs to the altar, he's to be taken from there for judgment. This tells us that religiousness cannot be used as a hiding place for wickedness. You know, the guilty man cannot run to the altar and say, well, I'm a pastor, so you can't touch me. And we see that in our world, don't we? And there's the bigger challenge here is, like, this calls out being two-faced, doesn't it? You know, Sunday Hass and Monday Hass cannot be two different people. Sunday worship must soak into Monday. You know, the reverence and love we sing about on a Sunday must carry into family life, into work life, into our friendships, into the situations when we're tired, annoyed, offended, or under pressure. And then we come to one of the most famous parts of the chapter, life for a life. That's verse 23-25. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. And people often read this and say, the Bible is giving permission, as if God is saying, go on, punch them back. That's not what's happening here. God is actually, in the ancient world, this was a way of instructing law courts to make sure that they were putting a control on proportionate justice. You know, it's a legal way to prevent punishments from just spiraling out of control. It's bringing restraint so that justice doesn't become vengeance. And as human beings, we are terrible at that, aren't we? I used to attend an Arabic school on a Saturday, and I remember once in class where the teacher was getting very cross because everyone was messing around, obviously except me because I'm a good boy. But then the teacher says, if anyone makes another sound, you will be sorry. And it was silent. And then my friend just went, hee-hee-hee-hee. And I've never seen someone so angry. The teacher actually grabbed him and he punched him and was like kicking him in the corridor. Of course, the teacher got fired, as he should have been. And that wasn't a proportionate response, was it? But that is what we're like in our hearts, isn't it? Right? We escalate. Someone hurts us just the once. And we want to pay them back 10 times over, don't we? That is the Egyptian way, right? Power without restraint. Retaliation without limits. But God's way is justice that is measured, proportionate. The time fits the crime, as the saying goes. God is showing them that Israel, you've come out of Egypt, but now Egypt must come out of Israel. Getting Egypt out of our power dynamics means we recognize the dignity of others and we restrain our desire for revenge. And that takes us on to point number two, getting Egypt out of our relationships. It's getting quite warm up here. I think John put the heating on again. So God limits the powerful to ensure Egypt is pushed out of Israel, but pushing Egypt out doesn't stop at the law courts. It has to bleed into how we treat our neighbors day to day. So God's justice has this compassion, this thread of compassion running all the way through it. And this transition into chapter 22 shows us something wonderful about the heart of God. You know, he's not distant to human suffering. He's not like Pharaoh. You know, Pharaoh heard the Israel groaning, and then he just demanded more, didn't he? God heard Israel groaning, and he came down to rescue them. You know, these laws here, they're love laws. They're how do you live your best life now? How do you do this in a good and right way? And now God says to Israel, you know what mercy feels like. You know what it is to cry out and need a deliverer. So do not receive my compassion and then deny compassion to others. So that's the thread running through this next section. Getting Egypt out of our relationships means we take responsibility for one another and we protect the vulnerable. We come to verse 18 and 19 where we have these two men, they're quarreling, one strikes the other. The injured man, he doesn't die, but he's hurt. And he's unable to work. And verse 19 says, the guilty man, he's got to pay for the loss of his time and make sure he is healed. Then the chapter ends with all the material about goring oxen in verses 28 to 36. And obviously, you know, when the oxen hurts someone, that's, you know, that's awful. But if you knew your ox was dangerous and you were warned and you didn't fence it in, then you are guilty of negligence. That's what that bit's about. So all in all, we should take full responsibility for our sin. You know, in the first section of chapter 22, we see that if you do wrong, you need to take responsibility. And more than that, you need to provide restitution. You need to be a restorer of things. You can't just walk away. In Egypt, the rule was self-preservation. Look out for number one. But in God's family, the rule is mutual responsibility. We're responsible for the harm we intend and the harm that we don't intend. You know, sin comes in the shape of action and inaction. So I don't think anyone here in Stowmarket owns any oxen. Please correct me if I'm wrong. But we possess things that wound other people if left unchecked. Our words are a big one. Our influence, our tempers. Often it happens right in our conversations, you know. If you're chatting with someone and then they just start gossiping, they start slandering a fellow church member or spreading a rumor, and you stay silent because it's awkward to speak up, you're letting the ox gore your neighbor. Other times, leaving the gate open looks like watching a brother or sister drift. You know, we live in a culture that the golden rule is mind your own business, but in the church, we are our brother's keeper, aren't we? If we see someone in the church who's slowly destroying their life, drifting into a dangerous relationship, drowning in bitterness, or pulling away from the Lord, and we choose to stay out of it because we don't want to cause offense, we're watching the ox wander straight into their house. The passage then focuses on the most vulnerable people in society. Look at verse 21. You shall not wrong a sojourner or oppress him, for you were sojourners in the land of Egypt. God roots their compassion in their redemption. He says, you know, you know what it feels like to be the outsider. So do not forget your story. And spiritually, that's the same for us, isn't it? We were strangers to grace. We were far off, and then God brought us in. How can we, who've been welcomed by mercy, become cold to the literal immigrant or refugee or outsider that doesn't fit into the tidy cultural mold of Stowmarket? God goes on to protect the widow and the fatherless in verse 22-24. You know, in that world, the widow, the fatherless, they had no power, they had no leverage, they had no protector. Then verse 26, we see this picture of someone with no money. It says, if a poor man gives you his cloak as a pledge or a loan, you must return it before the sun goes down. That sounds a bit strange, but what, you know, why does it matter that he should have his cloak before the sun goes down? Well, he's poor. It is his only covering. It's what keeps him warm at night. And I love that. Just think about that for a second. The God who spoke galaxies into existence, the God whose voice shook Mount Sinai, he cares whether a poor man is cold at night. God is saying, Israel, look, the courts, they might ignore you. The community, they might overlook you. But heaven hears you. God hears the cry of the grieving, the abused, the lonely, the poor, and the person who goes home from church carrying pain that nobody else sees. And if that's you this morning, you are not ignored. God sees you. God hears you. And if you're there, sitting there thinking, God doesn't care about me, yes, he does. If you trust in Jesus, God cares about you even more so because you're one of his people. He loves his people. In verse 27, he says he's compassionate. He's a compassionate God. And the word compassion, translated from the Hebrew, describes this active, intervening grace of a superior who stoops down to help a helpless inferior. God doesn't say, feel sorry for the cold man. He says, give him back his cloak. You know, biblical compassion acts. It stoops down. The God who heard Israel's cry in Egypt, he didn't just feel sorry for them. He came down and he rescued them. And just like Jesus came down and he rescued us, the high and mighty, infinite God, superior in every way, stoops down to help those helpless, inferior human beings, me and you. He commands his people to have the same attitude of humility and compassion. To be compassionate lovers of people. That's what this section is about. You know, we see that the heartbeat of these laws, Israel has come out of Egypt, but now Egypt must come out of Israel. Getting Egypt out of our relationships means we stop turning a blind eye. It means we take responsibility and we stoop down to lift others up. Point number three, getting Egypt out of our worship. Look at the very end of chapter 22, verse 31. God says to the people, you should be consecrated to me. In some translations, you shall be a holy people to me, set apart for me. Now, imagine inviting someone over for a Sunday roast. Say you are invited by the wonderful John and Liz, and they sit you down at the table, and then instead of bringing you out a succulent roast chicken and roast potatoes, they go to the back of the fridge, they pull out a slightly moldy piece of cheese, half a stale biscuit, and a bruised and wormy apple they picked from the garden. And they say, there you go, enjoy. You would be shocked, right? I'm pleased to say I don't believe they would ever do that. But the general rule we all know is you give your guest your best, don't you? And yet when it comes to our worship of the great creator of the universe, how often do we give him the scraps? You know, the leftover energy at the end of the week, the leftover change at the end of the month. Getting Egypt out of our worship means God no longer gets the leftovers. He gets the first fruits. In Egypt, Pharaoh demanded the absolute best, their time, their sweat, their strength. And now God says, you are a holy people to me. You are set apart. Your worship is about giving me your first and your best in every single area of your life. And as we step into chapter 23, we see exactly what that looks like. It starts with giving God our best obedience, even when it's uncomfortable. Now, let me give you an example. If you're driving down the A14 one afternoon and you saw your best mate stranded on the side of the road with a flat tire, you'd pull over and you'd help them immediately, wouldn't you? You would. But what if you looked closely, did a second take, and then you realized it wasn't your best mate? What if it was the bloke down the road who's been giving you a really hard time? What if it was the colleague who constantly undermines you? Would you stop, or would you pretend you didn't see them and keep driving? You know, the world says, it serves them right, that's karma, let them suffer. But we see in verse 4 and 5 of chapter 23, God says, nope, you help them. You know, if you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey going astray, you shall bring it back to him. You know, ox and donkey might not seem much to us, but in those days it was everything, it was your livelihood. If you see the donkey of one who hates you lying down under its burden, you shall refrain from leaving with it. You shall rescue it with him. So centuries before Jesus stood on a hillside and said, love your enemy and pray for those who persecute you, God was stressing the exact same radical holiness in the dusty streets of Israel. We're to do good to those who hate us. Why? Because while we were still enemies of God, he came and he rescued us. He redeemed us. And think about Israel. How many times does God rescue them, even while they reject him? They chase idols and follow their own desires. God doesn't give up on his people, even when they treat him like rubbish. And the passage kind of shifts gears in verses 10 to 13. God commands Israel to observe a Sabbath of sorts. For 6 years, they're to sow their land, and the seventh year, they must let it rest. And 6 days, they are to do their work, but on the seventh, they must rest. Let me ask you a question. When was the last time you asked someone, how are you doing? And they didn't reply with some version of, oh, you know, just so busy. Right? That's just a standard response that we hear all the time. Just so busy. Being busy has become kind of a badge of honor in our culture. You know, we live in a culture that idolizes the hustle. We're exhausted, we're burnt out, and we're constantly connected. If you aren't hustling, you must be doing something wrong. We define our worth in this culture by our work. You know, how many times when someone says, who are you? Oh, I'm Hass. I'm a senior, you tell them about what you do as a job. That's how we define our worth, right? By our work in this culture. Now, why is this a matter of holiness? Because remember where they've just come from. In Egypt, there were no days off. You know, Pharaoh's kingdom was a kingdom of relentless grinding production. You are only as valuable as the number of bricks you could make today. But Israel has come out of Egypt, and now Egypt must come out of Israel. So instead, God tells them and us that we're not defined by our work, what we produce. You know, they are called to stop working, to breathe and to rest, to actually switch off, to gather with God's people on a Sunday and just be in his presence. And for us, that's an act of holy defiance against the world that tells you you must constantly earn your keep. It is giving God the absolute best of your time. And I don't want to get into technicalities of keeping the Sabbath, but what is clear here is God says the Sabbath, the day of rest, is a good thing for us and for society. And in keeping it, in enjoying it, it is an act of trusting God that this is indeed good for us. Better than the hustle or anything else on offer. And finally, in verses 14 to 19, God speaks about their worship. He says in verse 19, take a look. The best of your first fruits of your ground you shall bring into the house of the Lord your God. Now, we already talked about the Sunday roast at John and Liz's, and here is where God makes it literal. You know, God doesn't want the leftovers. He doesn't want the end of the month spare change of your time or your energy or your finances. He wants the first and the best. And then right at the end of 19, there's this incredibly strange command, you shall not boil a young goat in its mother's milk. I will leave that one hanging for you to discuss on Wednesday. It's not a cop-out. It was in my sermon, but I had to take it out to get it under 2 hours. There's lots of different ways of looking at this. It could be referring to the fact that this was a cruel pagan ritual in Canaan, and God is simply saying, don't worship me using the dark, twisted methods of the culture around you. That's one idea. You know, he's saying, worship me how I've told you to worship me. Okay, no other way is okay. But I'll leave you to discuss that on Wednesday. And again, if you're not in a home group, let one of the elders know. We'll get you in one. Getting Egypt out of our worship means our whole lives change. It's not just a Sunday thing. You know, we leave vengeance to God and we bless our enemies. We reject Pharaoh's hustle and we trust God with our rest. And we refuse to give our king just the leftovers. And if we stopped reading there, we might feel entirely overwhelmed. Because God has just laid out a radical blueprint for getting Egypt out of our power dynamics, our relationships, our worship, and we ask, how can we actually live this out? But God makes a staggering promise in verse 20. He says he sends an angel. This is his very presence. He sends his very presence to go before them, to guard them, and to bring them home with this lovely phrase, little by little. And in verse 30, he tells them exactly how they will take this promised land. He says he'll drive out their enemies little by little. Historically, this meant that, you know, God, he wasn't going to clear the physical land of the Canaanites all at once. You know, otherwise, all the wild animals were taken over. You know, the victory was going to be progressive. The victory was going to be a patient one, a step-by-step walk to victory, not this overnight sprint. And that is exactly how God works in us spiritually. He declares us holy in Christ, and then he molds us into a holy nation, into his holy church, step by step, little by little. You know, redeemed people can only live holy lives because the holy God walks with them, transforming them one step at a time. And we desperately need him to walk with us. Because, church, if we're honest, there's still a lot of Egypt left in us, isn't there? The way the world operates seeps into our minds and hearts. The example I always think of is raising children. I never had to teach my children how to be naughty. They just absorbed it. And if we're honest, church, we use our power for ourselves, don't we? If we're honest, we exercise compassion only when it's convenient and it doesn't involve stooping down and being humble. If we're honest, we still give God our leftovers, don't we? Sunday has and Monday has can look completely different. If God's standard is perfect responsibility, perfect love of our neighbor, and perfect worship, then we are all guilty. In chapter 22, we see that God cares deeply about restitution, making things right, restoring the wounded, and through Jesus, our own restoration is possible. We feel wounded as we read this, as we read the Ten Commandments. We feel wounded because we know we can never live up to that. And yet in Jesus, our own restoration is possible. You know, Jesus Christ, he is the truly just one. There is no wrong in him. He is the true Israelite who never used his power selfishly. He never crushed the weak. He never exploited the vulnerable. He never ignored the hurting. And he always gave the Father his absolute best. And yet what happened to him? The just one was treated unjustly, wasn't he? At the cross, the righteous judge of all the earth stood silent before these crooked human judges that were and was executed as a law breaker. The one who deserved all honor and glory and praise was nailed to a cross. The one who stooped low in compassion was strung up high to a cross in shame. At the cross, God's justice and mercy meet, as we sing. God does not sweep our sin under the rug. Sin is judged. Sin is judged, and there are only two options. Option one. God's judgment for all your sin lands on you. And that should scare you if you have listened at all this morning. Because you know how big that debt is and you know you can't make it up. Or option number two, Christ takes that judgment for you. See, if you trust in Jesus, he gladly takes your sin, the punishment for your sin, the death you deserve for you. And if that's not compassion, I don't know what is. The guilty, they go free because the innocent one stands in their place. The debt is paid, justice satisfied, mercy can flow. See, if you are in Christ, you're not under this law as a ladder to climb into God's favor. You're under grace. And God does not leave you looking like Pharaoh, smelling like Egypt. He makes you look like Jesus. He took you out of Egypt, and now, little by little, by the power of the Holy Spirit, he is taking the Egypt out of you. Praise the King who bore my sin, took my place when I stood condemned. Oh, how good you've always been to me. I will sing of your mercy.